I got blood work done today, and the nurse told me she almost got the wrong vein. Now, if you're going to stick needles in someone, I would assume you know what you're doing. And if she's about to make a mistake, I guess she's telling me to let me know. But when I think about it, it's like, if nothing bad happened, why are you going to tell me? Because then I'm going to worry about it that you're actively using the wrong vein and not that you almost accidentally put it in. She actually took out 4 vials of blood, so that was uncomfortable and the area is bruised. Hello. Thank you. Hello.
That sounded like you were screaming into a void. Hello.
This is 1010 Wins.
Houston, we got a problem.
But this week, we are talking about something that I'm sure a majority of our audience, because you're all white, has listened or watched Disney princess films. So, Trisha, what was the first Disney princess film you can recall watching?
I can recall watching?
Yeah.
It's going to sound so crazy because we were just talking about it and I'm not even making it up, but the one I remember the most is Aladdin. Like, I feel like, and it's sad because I'm South Asian and obviously that was the expected answer. Maybe I just remember it more because of that. But like, I have a very fond memory of Aladdin. Like, no. Even to this day, if I watch it, I feel very strongly about it.
I'm not South Asian, but as a young Latina, seeing a non-white princess for the first time was iconic, you know? For me, I think the first one I can recall watching is The Little Mermaid. I actually watched it out of order, but part of why I loved it so much was because Ursula's Poor Unfortunate Souls is one of the greatest Disney songs ever written. And the fact that Ursula is most likely a drag queen. And while we can talk about how queer people are made as monsters in Disney films, I love that she's a drag queen. So yeah. I appreciate that being the first one I remember.
You're mentioning these movies and I'm having a very visceral process in which I can see them very clearly.
Yeah.
And by see them, I think if you're a certain age, you know what I'm talking about. I'm aging myself by talking like this, but only because I realized that I used to watch weirdly old versions of things even when I was a kid. But you know, when I was a kid, we didn't have like flat screen. Like I had that fat box TV and the VCR, and I have the VCRs of Little Mermaid and whatever, and you know when you would put it in and the little Disney would come and like it was really pixelated and weird and it was just gross.
Did you have a machine you'd put it in to rewind your VCR tapes?
No, so we had a thing, we had a VCR that was, you put it in the VCR to clean the VCR thing. You don't call the tape a VCR. I don't know why I'm saying that. But we had like a tape that you could put into the thing and it would clean it out and it would show something on the TV that was just like cleaning out your tape machine, whatever.
That's cute.
And then you could stick new DVDs. I mean, not DVDs.
Being a family of like known car enthusiasts, my dad, I don't know how he found this, had a red Ferrari that you put the tape in and it would rewind it for you. And then it would eject it. So the whirring of the noise sounded like it was an engine purring in the tape deck. And I have no idea where my dad found that, but I remember putting an Emperor's New Groove in there several times because that was my big watch.
I get that. But yeah, I'm just having weirdly visceral memories, which I guess could catapult our conversation in a way.
Yeah.
The fact that Disney still is so, there's no better word for actually Disney, I think, than visceral. Mm. The whole thing is very nostalgic, and I think they market on that.
Yeah, but absolutely.
It's not just a marketing tactic. Like, I would argue that Disney Channel really markets nostalgia, but in a way that's actually fully consumer, and I think back fondly on Disney Channel, but I don't feel a strong inherent sort of childhood in it. But if I think of Disney princesses, all of a sudden you just heard me cry about a VCR for 20 minutes. Like, you know, it's a marketing tactic. And I think about how strongly embedded Disney princesses really must be for me to have to open Pandora's box in my mind. Because we all know how much I don't like to do that.
You mean your memory palace?
Oh, don't do it. Don't talk about Hannibal. I'll cry.
But I suppose in a larger capacity, especially remembering these films, you remember it in the light of childhood, which is to say, when I remember The Little Mermaid, I think, oh, Ariel is so cool. She's curious. She's vaguely scientific in the way she pursues like the anthropology of humans. But then you get older and you realize, well, maybe she wasn't as progressive and today's standards as you remember. Maybe she turned out to be, she's 16, she's very whiny. She pursues lust over love. And you remember that she gives up her voice in the pursuit of a happily ever after. So I think our larger conversation is about whether we can reclaim Disney princesses.
Actually, I will bring up the article I read today because I think that that sort of, for me at least, answers the question in a way. So I read this article today, viewers, that I will link to the website, that basically suggested that Disney princesses in their time, right, because Cinderella pretty much came out in the 1940s or 1930s, something like that. Sleeping Beauty came out in the late 1950s. You know, the early Disney princesses were considered progressive for their time. And in this article, they sort of do a discourse analysis in which they find out that women actually spoke for 60 to 70% of these films, which was really, really uncommon in the time that they were produced. And so I guess the article really asks is, we look at them from a modern context and we problematize them, but you know, the problem might just be the generational gap between when they were made versus who we are. And so I read it and I thought, it's kind of true, right? If Disney princesses remain stagnant throughout time because they're supposed to be emblematic of childhood and people tend to view childhood as a very static part of life,
right?
Then I don't think we can reclaim them. I don't think there is a way to contextualize them in the appropriate fashion if they remain as static in comparison to modern views. Because it's not like we can just impose our views on Disney princesses. And I think you might disagree with this just because of the conversation we had about Greta Gerwig. I don't think you can necessarily impose your views on Disney princesses because there's no way to change the film, right? The only way to really maybe shift the thinking about them is before you show it to a child, you contextualize what's wrong with it, or you bring up, you know, the concerns you have about it and have a conversation before a viewing. But that's also making the assumption that your child would understand.
It's also making the assumption that all adults are capable of holding these conversations with their kids, right? Because obviously there's a lot of discourse on what's the best way to raise your kid in a socially responsible manner. And if there's anything to be said about the way sex education is being handled and how young do you teach your kids about consent and boundaries? I mean, in the case of like Snow White and Aurora from Sleeping Beauty, you see non-consensual kissing. These both princesses are arguably saved by princes. In order to have a socially responsible conversation with your kid about this, you have to be in the position to be comfortable having those conversations already. Not a lot of adults are also equipped with the right language to teach kids about this also.
Well, it's also a matter, I mean, that's absolutely true, but it's also a matter, unfortunately, of the gender of your child.
Yes.
Right? Because I think we're coming at it as girls, and as women, you hold a certain fondness for Disney princesses. But I've often thought about the opposite, which is like young boys. It's not like young boys don't know about Cinderella or they've never heard of Sleeping Beauty. They have. I don't really know if they've ever seen the movies. But a lot of young boys have seen Beauty and the Beast. They know the stories. They know this. But I think they've often been taught not to think critically about them or to not even... Because for them, there's no male figure in those, right? Even Aladdin, although primarily male, arguably was not a boy's movie. It was still made with the focus of marketing the young girls. So there's, I mean, I find it very interesting that Disney princesses are really based on the fact that it's a lesson for girls, but it's entertainment for boys.
Absolutely.
So there also has to be something to be said about adults. I mean, it's up to adults to stop making that distinction as well. Because when you choose to show your children these movies, you may even subconsciously do so in a divide. You may show your girl children these movies, or you may want them to dress up like a princess on Halloween and not consider the same thing for your boy child or for your gender fluid child or, you know, whatever. So it's more than even having the conversation, it's first bridging the divide between the sort of stereotypical gender norms Disney put out in these movies. Because if you can do that in real time, then I think the message changes.
I think on that vein of the way these Disney princesses are marketed for young girls and young boys, we can see in the more modern movies how the way the princesses are marketed, it's made to be more inclusive, at least in the case of Moana, right? Moana does not have a love interest. The movie is more about culture and family, and I've seen, at least personally, I've seen a lot of boys get really excited about this because she's not depicted as stereotypically feminine. And in the case of like subverting, you know, like seeing the birds and singing with like little mice and stuff, when we see the way princesses are portrayed with more autonomy, I think that's the way Disney is trying to get more boys to see this as also a lesson in how to be a good person.
I also think Disney has done a really great job of moving away from, again, static choices. So instead of adhering to certain boxes, especially in terms of females, I think they've also done it with their male characters. Because if you look at their earlier films, right, you know, from Cinderella onward to Little Mermaid, to Sleeping Beauty, to Snow White, all these films, the male character is some sort of prince. And he's some sort of upstanding, aristocratic, very good-looking dude, right? And so a lot of males also aren't going to watch that in the sense that it's not masculine necessarily. I mean, it was masculine again for the times.
Yeah.
But a lot of young boys, as modern day grows old, the aristocratic sort of bourgeoisie white male becomes really out of touch. And I think they've done a great job of sort of developing their male characters as vulnerable and emotional support systems for their female characters, as opposed to sexually autonomous and aggressive males from the 1950s, right? And again, to bring up Moana, Maui does that almost perfectly, where he's a god, but he's a god that is struggling, and he's a god that has failed, and he's very vulnerable in his failure at some point.
Yeah.
And yet he is still masculine. Like, that's a beautiful thing about Maui, is he still puts out that sort of masculine energy that will make boys sort of excited to watch this kind of character. Mm-hmm. But in watching the movie, you also realize that Maui can be both masculine and vulnerable, and they're not diametrically opposed concepts.
Yeah, I think if we're going to talk about masculinity on a larger scale, I want to redirect the conversation to Brave. With Princess Merida. Have you seen that movie? Oh, it looks like you have, because you're snapping.
Yeah, I care about Brave, and I know you're probably going to say something about it.
I am. I think I remember Brave coming out, and it having this almost primary step in the way Disney was taking its redirection, right? Because I think this was actually the first film in their Disney Princess line in which a princess didn't have a love interest. And so we see Merida, we see the movie itself is a conversation about mother-daughter relationships, but also the ways in which femininity and masculinity can damage who you are as a person. So we see Merida as having stereotypically male characteristics. She's brash, impulsive, and vaguely gross, which was kind of cool to see in a princess, but she's also an incredible archer. And so it's the first time we see these different ideas of what masculinity is in the three men who vie for her approval. We see the ditzy boy, we see the jock, the asshole. And I think that was also a great way at teaching young boys that there one wasn't one good way to be a man, because in the end, it's not the violence or the strength of the male characters that saves the film. It's ultimately the idea of being emotionally vulnerable as well, but in a less obvious way with Maui.
Arguably, I think Brave taught little boys to learn how to be women, and I stand by it. I think all men should just turn into women. It's the better gender.
She said misandry.
I really did. I said just switch. But real talk, I agree. I think the greatest thing that Brave did was sort of put men in the same trope that women have been held in for years, right? Like we talk about in the episode, cool girl, sad girl. But instead of doing that to Merida, they put it on the men who are vying for her hand in marriage. And so it's a beautiful thing for little boys to see that, you know, none of those work if you're not also an upstanding person, right?
Yeah.
And I think that when they started moving sort of from arguably like appearance-based lesson giving to moral-based lesson giving in their movies, it was kind of one of the best things that ever happened to them.
Yeah.
Because I think for a long time, Disney sort of put out manners and behavior and respectable societal lessons, which were obviously, again, a sort of the times.
Yeah.
But they have a very notable shift that arguably comes with like Mulan. Even earlier, actually, I would argue it came with Pocahontas, where the shift goes from appearance-based learning to morals and to values, and their movies start putting out sort of fable-like lessons.
Yeah.
That I'm very fond of. They may not go about it the best way, right? Like Pocahontas obviously has its problems.
It does.
Mulan obviously has its problems. But the attempt is there, and I argue that the lesson by the end of it still comes across as it needs to.
Yeah. I think now that we've set up the background, if you don't mind, I'd like to go not one by one with a focus on all the princesses, but the ones I think that are the most contentious, specifically starting with Cinderella, right? Because she's, I don't think she's technically the first princess, if I'm thinking of it correctly. Snow White is technically the first, but I prefer to start with Cinderella because I think when we think of like the face of the anti-Disney princess ideology, Cinderella is the one that's lauded as anti-feminist, right? Because Prince Charming is literally seen sweeping her off her feet, but that's not really the case. We see that her arc is all about kindness, compassion, and resilience. And I think the film is more of a take on how familial abuse can shape a person. She is sentenced essentially as an indentured servant in her own house. And what she needs to escape from is being undervalued and abused by her family. And she uses royalty as an escape, sure, but it's not what really rescues her. What rescues her is her ability to be kind enough to attract the actual advocates who will help her, seeking help, accepting it, and fighting at all costs to escape her fate. She also doesn't have the option of just living by herself. That's not the norm for women in her time period, nor is it acceptable in her village. She's also an unmarried young woman. I'm assuming the only other options would be to enroll in sex work. That's not something that's going to be explored in a Disney film, you know?
Cinderella the prostitute, Cinderella 2. I would love to see that. No, I also think, you know how you just said that Cinderella, interestingly, is the face of anti-feminism in Disney princesses? I think Cinderella is also just the face of Disney princesses. You know, at least for me, as long as I could remember, Cinderella has been the emblem of Disney. Like, there's Mickey Mouse as, like, Disney, and then Cinderella is, like, right behind him, sort of, you know? as like the next, I guess, Disney idea, which is funny because if you've ever seen the Disney logo, right, it's the castle and it's supposed to be Disney World. But I'm pretty sure that's just the castle for like literally every Prince Charming. It's like that's the castle for Cinderella, right? Like that's the whole idea. Disney also does the thing with the magic wand, right? That comes from the fairy godmother. Like Cinderella is so embedded in what Disney is supposed to mean that I think it's very interesting that she has now become the most controversial, you know, choice. I agree with what you have said about her, that in a way that she is actually very progressive in the ideals as a character that she's supposed to be pushing out. However, I think that that case is a little unbelievable to me, only because I don't think Cinderella really does any of those things, right? Like, she's abused and sort of enslaved in her home, and she, like, makes do by, like, being happy with the rats and the mice and chilling. And somehow her docility and her manners are supposed to be emblematic of her goodness in the face of obstacles, which lends her a fairy godmother that puts a time limit on her imagination. And then she loses. Also, you have to understand that Cinderella also comes from the Grimm's fairy tales. Like, a lot of these things come from the Grimm's fairy tales.
Those are her boys.
Yeah. And Disney really said, no, we'll put a cute little white spin on it. And then they do, where this white woman is able to accomplish her dreams just by wanting to.
You're telling me that's not attainable for a little brown girl?
And while that's great, there's also something problematic, I think, in teaching little girls that they must be good and good-natured in the face of any obstacle, and that somehow will get them their dreams. Because the truth is, if there's no pushback, you remain indentured in some way or the other, right? Like, if you refuse to revolt, there is no fairy godmother, you know.
Of course. That's,
yeah, creating a carriage for you. And obviously, there has to be some suspension of disbelief. Like, it's a little child's story. But yeah, I would find the argument that she is more revolutionary, more believable, I think, if the story actually had elements of Cinderella ever doing anything herself, other than just being weirdly good-natured the entire story.
No, those are fair points. I don't mean this argument to be completely absolving the film of its flaws, obviously. I would say that she is a bit more rebellious than we think. She does have moments in which she is rightfully pissed off with the cat specifically. I think if the Disney princesses were allowed to curse, I mean, the cat's literally named Lucifer. And even at the end of the film, she does display anger. She's not completely good-natured. I think we have to accept that that's her method of just being pissed off and just self-pitying in that point, which is okay.
Yeah. I mean, again, right, like, I understand where it's coming from, but I grew up in a time where I look at those and I say those flaws are just not realistic enough. Mm. Like, if her flaw is having a little bit of, like, literally the least amount of rage at being enslaved in her own home, then I sit there and I wonder and I'm like, yeah, if you think women are only going to be that angry if you deny them their rights, then you're wrong. Because women have much deeper feelings than that. And they're more complex than simply to be erased by a Prince Charming or the option of wealth.
So, who would be the most natural transition to talk about this? Because I feel like familial abuse is something we continually see in a lot of Disney films, actually.
It is true. I don't know. I feel like Rapunzel actually is a really good one because I noticed that in your notes, you had written about the new Rapunzel, because, you know, when I say Rapunzel, I think a lot of people think Tangled now.
Yeah.
But before Tangled came out, there was like the legitimate Rapunzel.
The original story is so scary.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like the original story. And I think now, especially, you know, I was reading your notes and I kept thinking to myself that I brought up Rapunzel in student teaching and everyone immediately thought of Tangled. And yeah. They were like, it's a great story and I love Flynn Rider and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I love Tangled. I hate Rapunzel. That is a really garbage
story. When you're saying you hate Rapunzel, you're referring back to the essence of the original story.
Yes, okay. I'm referring to the original story, period. Not even the essence. I legitimately hate the story. It used to scare me. When I was a kid and I wrote... I don't even want to talk about this because it's going to make me seem like such a dweeb. In class, we were given the opportunity, I think it was elementary school or middle school. We were basically given the opportunity to remix a Disney story. Mm. And you got the chance to basically put it in a modern context. And because I was a little Wayne loving kid, I wrote Rapunzel. And she was a rapper. And I wrote the whole thing in rhyme because I thought rapping was just about rhyming.
This is appropriative, Trisha.
it was no bueno. And it was no good. But I remember even when I was rewriting it, right, I had to revisit the original story.
Yeah.
And there was not a single part of it. The only reason I knew she could be a rapper, and this sounds horrible, but it's true. It's the only reason I made her a rapper is because her home life and her general life lend itself really well to the trajectory of rappers. Because I was like,
the rags to riches storyline.
Yeah. Except by the end, Rapunzel's not rich. There's no rags to riches. She's just blind. Yeah.
Is she blind or is it... the guy who
Her love interest is blind.
Yes,
but she also just nothing good comes out of this for her. It's weirdly
She's left alone to be pregnant.
Yeah, it's just this like weird Oedipal ending. I don't know. I think Rapunzel is a very interesting story of familial abuse, especially because it's the chosen family in a sense. She doesn't choose, you know. Her mother, quote unquote, her mother chooses her. Gothel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mother Gothel sort of picks her up and takes her away. And she's not only enslaved, but literally locked away.
Yeah.
Years and years and years and indoctrinated to the point of just ridiculousness. But I think the very interesting thing about this story before Tangled is that Disney does nothing to sort of subvert the sort of Freudian dynamic between Mother Gothel and Rapunzel and her thieving her. There's a weird sense of like this idea of Rapunzel, let down your hair and like helping your mother and mom's knowing best. And even at the end of the day, if Mother Gothel was evil, there's a weird sort of empathy for her embedded into the narrative.
Yeah.
You know, because she didn't have anything and now she has Rapunzel and she's just nervous that it'll be taken away from her. So I think sometimes the values it puts out is that your parents know what's best for you and may seem oppressive to you, but it's only because they're scared, which is not the case.
That's so funny because I don't see it that way. I actually think the film does a great job of pinning Mother Gothel as a character you have to hate. I don't think they pose any empathy with her. I think...
Well, are you talking about Tangled?
Tangled.
Yeah, I'm not talking about Tangled. I mean the legitimate story, right? Like the Disney version of Rapunzel.
Okay, the way you phrased it confused me.
Yeah, no. I'm talking pre-Tangled Mother Gothel Rapunzel, like OG story. I think there's a deep sense of empathy embedded in her actions.
Well, yeah, because the Grimm brothers ultimately wrote their stories as methods to control children, to scare them into obedience. Yes.
Right. Yeah. So, like, there's a sense of familial abuse in that Entangled sort of gets subverted a little bit. But before Tangled, Disney did nothing to deny these claims. They said, yeah, Rapunzel let down her hair for her mother, and it was fine and good.
Tangled?
Yeah.
They didn't do anything with Rapunzel pre-Tangled.
Have they not?
No, Rapunzel was their very first... Tangled was their very first take on Rapunzel.
Okay, Disney, we love you for that.
I remember when Tangled came out, people were complaining because they were like, that's like calling the Little Mermaid beached.
Wow. So you want to hear what's so funny about that? I always thought Disney did a Rapunzel thing before that, but I'm realizing why I think that is because I was genuinely so traumatized from the OG story that I just attested it to Disney because I was like, who else would write this?
I mean, they are the literal face of capitalism. They are scary. It makes sense.
I mean, for our listeners, if you've never read it, genuinely, Rapunzel, look, the original story, traumatizing levels of family abuse and empathy for poor parental choices.
So now that we're on the subject of Tangled itself,
yes.
I think the film does a great job of showing that, at least I've can't speak for, being a victim of like familial abuse or not. That's not something I'm familiar with, but I will say, from what I've read, it seems like they're doing a great job of showing how complicated that relationship is, because even at the end of the film, when Mother Gothel dies, it appears that Rapunzel is rightfully upset, but it's in the case of like remorse, you know, of still wanting to love this person who raised her, but also recognizing how much damage was inflicted on her for her 18 years of life.
Yeah. Well, I also still, I mean, I love Tangled, like genuinely, genuinely love that movie. I think in part Disney still empathizes with Mother Gothel in a real way, but it's again in your favor. It's like, I agree with you. They do it in a way that's more complex than just simply saying that your parents know best, you know, and whatever kind of parent you have, you know, biological or otherwise. I feel like Disney does a really great job in Tangled of sort of lining that empathy with a reasonable level of autonomy, which is a great lesson actually for children in empathy in general.
Yeah.
It's that you can't just simply feel things for someone or feel for someone even if they don't deserve it.
Hmm.
Which is kind of sad that Disney took that long. If Tangled was really their first dabble in that, it took them a very long time to get to that message. Which actually kind of reminds me, I mean, not to like totally switch topics, reminds me of Elsa. Because I think they intended the same thing sort of with her Frozen character, which is that you can have empathy for something, but also not understand it and maybe not even like it.
Yeah.
And then choose autonomy. Which is what she does, because she literally leaves and she's like, I'm going to build my own ice castle, you know? And she's like, I really empathize with people being afraid of me, but I know what's good for me and I don't have to feel bad, whatever.
I would also argue because, oh, you were about to say, however, finish your however.
I was just going to say, however, I think the difference really between Frozen and Rapunzel in this case is that Elsa definitely has a lot more independence throughout the film to break away from certain things before Rapunzel gets the chance to do that.
Mm. I would also like to say both films emphasize that in the independence, you can learn so much more than you think you can without your parents. And also because of the way the empathy lessons are portrayed, I feel like it's, if we're breaking it down in like really simple terms, it's selflessness can be really dangerous when it's in excess. And I would argue that at the end of both films, Elsa and Rapunzel respectively learn how to be selfish.
Yes. I actually do think with their newer films, kind of like Frozen and Tangled, Disney is sort of pushing out a message of like blatant individualism that propagates America's national agenda in a really horrifying way.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. In which they're creating little women who are who are autonomous and feminist, which is great, but also women who buy into the idea that they can cultivate great qualities in isolation and don't need anybody else.
Yeah. Well, I would say that at least in Frozen, it's two princesses who do that together. They're individuals together. They are propelling sisterhood, even if it's flawed.
Yes, but in Frozen, I don't think people would characterize necessarily Anna and Elsa in the same way, especially because Anna not only just presents different qualities, mm-hmm. she also adamantly accepts the help of everyone around her and is very much like a social and community, the communal figure, who I think she actually is like the opposite of what Disney is trying to portray as like quote unquote strong female.
Yeah.
I don't think they deny her a strong female, but I don't think they make her necessarily strong because she's arguing.
Strong with a capital S or strong as in regular definition?
No, strong with a capital S, like female strong, right?
Yeah.
But Elsa, in choosing to leave and sort of cultivate her own powers in isolation and in separation, is for some reason defined as some magical, powerful girl. But I think it's, and it's sort of, this came up when we were watching Indian Matchmaking, but I think Disney sometimes tends to forget that vulnerability and emotionality and being able to build connections and understand people is a level of strength that is more powerful than individualistic freedom.
Well, isn't that what Elsa comes to, the conclusion at the end of the film? That she that she needs people?
Well, see, I think the conclusion she comes to is that she needs her sister. But I don't think the conclusion she comes to is, I need people. Because if you think about it, her closest friend in this, actually, he wasn't even her friend. Olaf was Anna's friend, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so forget it. She still doesn't need anything. She comes to the conclusion about her sister alone.
Well, in the end of the first movie, yes.
I've seen Frozen 2.
Also, the Frozen shorts. I think the arc of all those films shows that, at least by Frozen 2, Elsa is not, I wouldn't describe her as warm necessarily, but you see her interacting with far more people. And when she meets the native people in the forest, she develops these really deep connections to them, specifically Honey Marin. Spoilers, pretty sure they're gay. Pretty sure they're romantically interested in each other, even if it's not specifically canon. But I think, yeah, she does come to that conclusion. There is a community she forms by the end.
I mean, like, I can't speak to any of the other movies. I just know that by the first one,
but that's okay.
I hated the first one. So there you go. I never watched any of the other ones. But if that's the case, then my point is null and void. But I think if you've only ever seen the first one, like me,
yeah,
you don't see that at all.
And that's a good point to make. Because the other, at least Tangled, even though they have sequels and like a really great series as well, Rapunzel does come to a community in the end.
Yeah. See, the great thing about Tangled is that once she is released, she is able to create community. Mm-hmm. However, the point I still want to impinge on here is that she somehow cultivates her great personality in isolation like that, where she like somehow is good natured and good mannered and empathetic and kind. And in no way, I think any psychologist out there, if you're listening, DM us, because I don't know, but I feel like most psychology people would argue that's not beneficial. And most people would not cultivate those attributes by themselves in a situation where they were locked away in darkness day after day.
In the case of Rapunzel, being good-natured was probably the safest route for her, right? Because it's not so much being good-natured as it is being like complacent and obedient, because the opposite.
It's definitely the safest route within the tower, but it's the fact they consistently stay that good-natured from beginning to end of the movie, with little to no shift in character. So these women are sort of, again, statically good, however you want to characterize good in the most national sense.
Yeah.
Which I think is slightly problematic, because I think Rapunzel, once let out, would have to have had moments of serious behavioral thinking. And again, suspension of disbelief is necessary. It's a child's movie, but because I'm an adult, partially, I find it hard to believe.
So I think in the case of, if we're talking about good natured and like actual consequences, we have to bring the conversation back to Moana, because Moana is a Moana. I hold that Moana is the greatest Disney princess of all of them. We don't have to argue that, but what I'm saying is that that's a princess that we see is acting her age as 16. She is not given, the only adult responsibility she's given is the fact that she has to step up and lead her island. But she also misbehaves, and she is yelled for it. And so we see her go through this growth period of like childlike stubbornness. And she's good natured the whole time, but we see her actually fail and get frustrated with herself and give up. I don't know. Seeing those range of emotions in that film is really cool. Okay, yell at me, Trisha. What are you going to say?
I just want to say that Jasmine did it first, and then Mulan did it second, and then Moana came through, okay? I would say Moana arguably is the perfected version of both of those characters I just mentioned. Like, she's, like, the most fully realized.
Yes.
But my girl Jasmine, kiss, kiss, hug, hug, did it first.
No, Jasmine, I guess we can take a tangent. Jasmine is great. She fights for autonomy. She is rebellious. I mean, what is it? The live action film, I forget the actress who played her. Her song Speechless. Speechless was good.
Naomi Scott.
Naomi Scott. Yes. Mo from Lemonade Mouth. The song was great. Speechless was great. But at the end of the day, I don't know. I feel like Jasmine is swept by it. She is swept aside because she's collateral. It doesn't matter whether she misbehaves or not, because ultimately she's always going to end up with a prince. It's not like she's, it's not, I think what she's fighting for, if we're saying it in purely feminist 21st century language, she wants to be the ruler by herself on her own. She wants what she's fighting for is choice. And I think with choice also comes with like time, where she gets to set her own schedule. And if that means ruling by herself when her father passes, that's okay. But I think ultimately the film positions it that she is, her rebellion and her good naturedness will always end up with Prince, which feels more like a chain to me.
I don't know. I don't necessarily see Jasmine as always ending up with the prince. I think she just happens to, because Aladdin exists and he just happens to be a decently well-written male character. But I do think after that very disturbing scene with Jafar and her sort of tied up in this weird space that they recreate, by the way, in Star Wars, and everyone can fight me on that, but Jabba the Hutt,
Aladdin walks so Star Wars could run.
Yeah, literally. Jabba the Hutt just is Jafar, and Leia is Jasmine.
Unfortunately, sexual exploitation of women is not an original thing.
It never gets old, actually. But I think that especially after that scene, it becomes less about whether or not she's going to end up with a prince, but the fact that she has to end up with the choice. And I don't think the choice is between being alone or being with the prince. I think the choice is just trusting someone who has lied to you, or I guess it's not even trusting someone that's lied to you, it's trusting yourself to know what's best for you and what's best for the duty you've been given, which is what Moana just happens to do by herself, except she doesn't really do it by herself, right? Instead of having a prince, she has her grandmother. Instead of having sort of a sidekick tiger, she has Maui.
I thought you were going to say she has a chicken.
Yeah, no, I don't like to talk about the chicken because I don't think that chicken is funny at all. I actually just think it's really stupid and I hated that in general, as I anger people everywhere. But Yeah, I think Jasmine actually makes a choice internally about whether or not she can trust herself to make the right choices. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a much more beautiful message, because I don't think the story, even though it's called Aladdin, I don't think the story was ever about Aladdin. No. I think it was about Jasmine learning to make choices for herself without her father and without, you know, whoever. Which is, again, what I see in Mulan. This is why I brought them up at the same time, is because while I recognize that there are problematic aspects and that there's always going to be a love interest in some sense, like, see, even though Moana doesn't have a love interest, was it Tefiti, right? That's the name of the god, goddess?
Yeah.
Her, the whole reason this stuff happens, wasn't it because of a lover?
Yes, being scorned in some capacity, yeah.
Yeah, there you go, right? Like, humanity gets destroyed by this sort of vengeful goddess being scorned by a lover. In some sense, I think Disney's always reproducing a love interest, whether the main character has it or not. Mm-hmm. There's some sense of, like, heteronormative structures.
Well, we can argue that on a larger scale, a lot of stories always have to do with some aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just always the case, but Disney being a microcosm of greater storytelling continuously reproduces hetero values. And so instead of arguing that they're always doing that, I think I like to see the way they're doing it and how they're doing it better. Because in Mulan, while Li Shang is sort of important, the real story is not about Li. It's about, again, internal choices Mulan has to make and decide to become who she is. And Li just happens to be a part of that. Like I said, I think Disney's also just reversing the way masculinity is viewed. They have a long way to go in terms of actually propagating gender, but so long as they stay to heteronormative behaviors, the least they could do is what they're doing, which is portraying men in a more nuanced and supportive way rather than, you know, the main lead hero.
I would like to also point out that the three princesses we're talking about as the most autonomous and most revolutionary, Mulan, Jasmine, Moana, are also non-white princesses. And it seems that the perception of these non-white cultures as oppressive has its own conversations, of course, but I think it's really cool to see actual cultures being dissected, even if they're not being done in the most respectful and socially responsible ways. They're given a platform.
Yeah, I do also see that, where it's like people tend to pick on Disney, which I totally get, like, pick on Disney, homie. I'm not saying it's the best thing ever. But especially when I think back to Pocahontas, it's like when you are the first to do something, especially if it's for children, there is a very fine line between being appropriative and being informative in a way that's digestible. Mm. And I don't mean just digestible for white people. I generally mean digestible for children. So yes, do I see the problems in Pocahontas?
Yeah.
Obviously. Do I see the issues in Mulan? Obviously. However, it's not like Disney didn't consult people, right? When they made Pocahontas, they got an indigenous voice for Pocahontas. They consulted indigenous people and said, like, you know, let's consider what this would look like. Obviously, they took some liberties, which white people just tend to do. But if you were the first to do something and you're trying to do it for kids, there has to be a moment where you're like, okay, what is going to make this watchable as a consumer? And this is, again, the problem we had with Mindy Kaling, right? It's at the end of the day, there's a very ugly line between cultural accuracy and capitalist consumerism.
Yeah.
And Disney has to very much play to both in a way that adults obviously can't appreciate, but children eat up like it's their favorite meal in the whole world.
And now, because diversity is being seen as the trend, obviously when we hear that Moana has had consultation and heavy influence with actual Polynesian people, that's part of the ploy to get more people to come and to support this scene. Especially with Frozen 2, when the film actually consulted I forget the name of the people in Scandinavia, the native people there, to the film, it was seen as part of the reparations for colonialism there.
But you also have to think about, I mean, here's the end all, I feel like for me, like the thing I really have to say about Disney film is you just have to know, consciously know what you're watching it for. Like if you go into a Disney film thinking you're about to watch this thing for a deep analysis of femininity and family and masculinity, then that's not what you're gonna watch. I'm sorry, but that's just not, these are children's films and it's just not gonna get that real.
Yeah.
But if you watch it knowing that in some sense you'll learn something good and you will feel good a little bit about human nature and the human condition, then you're in for a good ride. Like arguably, I think Disney as a whole has at least presented good conversations for children and adolescents. Even if they're not perfect, they're a starting point for those conversations to get perfect or for those discourses to open between your child and you and your family and whatnot. You have to know what you're watching it for. And if you watch it for the right thing, then it's going to be really fruitful for you. If you're 40 years old and you know too much and you're hardened by the world, sorry, don't watch it then. Like, it may not teach you anything.
Yeah.
Sorry, my brain is literally blanking right now.
No, it's fine. I mean, that was pretty much my, I just stan Disney. And while I find certain princesses highly problematic, I think overall it's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. Context is always needed.
Well here's a question I would ask you is, like, would you show your kids Disney movies, like Disney films from your childhood? So that includes Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, Snow White. Like, would you show your kids these films?
As educational tools, yes. I think in general with anything I have my kids watch from my childhood, Disney or not, I want to start having conversations about it because there are obviously lessons your kids will pick up on, and take it with them as they get older. I think most of us can agree that we grew up with this idea of, at least I can say, from like Snow White and Aurora, that the prime thing to be is to be good is to be beautiful, and to be beautiful is everything you need. And that's how you'll survive, and that it's okay to be rescued by a prince because when he kisses you without your consent, it's love. And I never want those indirect lessons to be taught without being addressed.
Yeah. I mean, sort of to caveat my earlier point, obviously, like I said, if you're thinking too critically, it's a detriment. But if you're only watching these for entertainment as a parent or as a sister or a nephew or whatever, you need to start engaging with these movies a little critically as well. There's a really, there's like a middle between just watching them for fun and then watching them for like content analysis. And I think when you're showing them to children, especially, and you're in a position where you can do both. And open the conversation, especially, if you're a kid. I often hear celebrities especially will like talk about their kids like singing songs from Disney movies all day long or watching things and whatever. And they'll be like, it's so annoying and it's so funny. And I'm like, yeah, but when your kid like sings these songs, right? And like these lyrics, or you're hearing them every single day, you ever wonder what's appealing about it to them? Like, do you ever actually talk to your kids about why they find that so appealing and like what about this seems so great to them and why Elsa or why Moana or why, Mulan is the best thing to them, and it's probably going to be their favorite thing for the next 5 years? Like, I don't really have a way to end that. I feel like it's the only way I could.
I don't think I had an idea for how this conversation was going to pan out, especially because it seems like we're on the same page for most of this. And that's not to say a podcast episode has to be combative.
No, I just think I am combative.
No, you can speak for both of us. We share the same brain cell.
Yeah, we actually are soup of the ocean. We're ocean soup.
I don't know. I just want to say that this episode was harsh, at least for me when I suggested it. It was inspired by this video I saw on YouTube hosted by The Take. They're a great feminist YouTube channel in which they examine tropes in films and movies, hence the Cool Girl video that they have, which is one of the best analysis I've seen. But they had a video on how Cinderella should be taken seriously. You know, I don't know if we said this earlier, you specifically said this earlier, Trisha, it's just the lessons of like kindness and compassion are just undervalued. And it's something that we should revisit today, especially now when our kids are obviously picking up on cancel culture and what it means to be canceled. And they partake in that with a mob mentality, not because they understand what's going on, it's just because they're kids. But maybe, to quote the great Harry Styles, if we all just treat people with a little kindness, the world will be fine.
Why did you have... You could have quoted literally any, you could have quoted Bob Dylan, you could have quoted John Lennon, you could have quoted any musician from the 60s and 70s.
You're telling me Harry Styles, who has been approved by Stevie Nicks, and she did compliment his album and say it's one of the best albums ever. You're going to tell me you don't agree with Stevie Nicks, the literal goddess of Fleetwood Mac?
Give me 30 seconds, okay?
I hate everything you're typing into Google right now. I don't want it.
I'm just saying.
I just also want to say Trisha didn't know who One Direction was when we met, and I think that's incredibly
interesting. Whoa. You don't have to expose me like that. Guys, I totally knew who they were. They were boys.
Did she really?
They were boys, and they were...
They were the boys?
Singing. They were boys, and they sang. No, I did kind of remember because I knew that song. No, I didn't. I don't know.
No, you really didn't.
I literally can't even picture them. Like, you're saying their name, and I'm like, who's in that band? I was gonna say, by the way, Stevie Nicks, I love her, and she queen, but you know, John McVie might disagree with her assessment.
I don't care. She's the only member of Fleetwood Mac I really care about, so.
Oh, you're really going to say that?
Well, Christine was cool.
Okay.
I just clearly.
You're just going to say that?
I'm not a fan of Lindsay.
You're ill. You're sick in the head.
I mean, if you read J.C. Jones in The Six, you'll eventually come to the same conclusion.
That's not a nonfiction story.
It was based on Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, but it's not nonfiction. It's a fictional story based on...
I would argue that all stories are essentially nonfiction.
Oh, that's a hot take that we don't need to get into. That's crazy. All stories are nonfiction.
I literally...
Imagine if that was the case for Disney stories. Do you realize what you just said? Scary. Galaxy Bird.
I just said, Maleficent, come for me, please. Especially if you're looking like Angelina Jolie.
Oh, man. I didn't even get a chance to bring up in this podcast about my paternity death drive.
Is that something we could argue in the case of Disney princesses?
Yes, Beauty and the Beast. 130%, I'd be arguing that.
Okay, Trisha, say it. Go ahead.
Okay, should I argue it in the case of Beauty and the Beast? I forgot her dad's name.
State the basis of what it is, and let's see if we can apply it.
So, my theory is that all men... Wait, no, this is wrong. I already started wrong. All fathers want to kill their daughters. Okay, let me explain. Paternity, right, being a father is all about legacy, right? Mm. And so it's about continuing legacy because legacy means power. And so if you can continue this sort of patriarchal way of life, you're Gucci. If you have a son and daughter, legacy can only continue if the son outlives the mother and daughter. Mm. In order for that to happen, not only would they need to die of natural causes, but the father actually would have to diminish their livelihood to the point where they would die early, right? So in a sense, I'm also talking about a metaphorical passing away that fathers perpetuate by squashing the hopes and dreams and freedoms of their female counterparts. Now, the second part of this point is also that if a father is the easily categorized opposite of mothers, and mother is the life giver, and being maternal means always giving and sacrificing, then fatherhood must be the naturally inclined opposite that is the life taker. And so paternity is inherently death driven. Okay.
You're good.
No, I'm just saying, so now if you think about it, apply this to things you've seen, right? So Beauty and the Beast, right? Her mom dies. And then her dad does stupid shit to the point where she gets stuck in a castle in a barter for his life. And then she gets Stockholm Syndrome and marries a vapid prince. It's cut years off of her life.
We can also apply this to Frozen, you know, with Elsa specifically, right? Her father is primarily the reason behind all of her fear and essentially putting her in the closet. And so when he dies in the shipwreck with his wife, Elsa still remains in her room. And so it becomes this death of self for her. You know, because her father is trying to squash who she is. Even if he does it in the name of like safety for herself and for everyone else, it ultimately becomes you are a weapon that will implode upon yourself. And you should be aware of the collateral you will cause.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, it could even be applied to Rapunzel, because Mother Gothel is the thing keeping her alive. But the absence of the father also means that the legacy, technically, there's no legacy to protect. So Rapunzel is put in this really horrible situation that admittedly will probably, it's sort of a death of self, right? A death of independence, a death of autonomy in her that is reproduced by paternal absence.
Oh, shit. Jay's story, you gonna publish this?
I'm just saying this theory is just getting more and more concrete in my head as the days go on. And
if you know of any theorists that actually talk about this as paternity is like inherently murderous, please send them our way. We'd love to read this.
Well, I think Freud? Somebody has this thing called the death instinct. Yeah, it is Freud. No, I forgot what it was about. I know it's not about this, but I remember thinking in my head that I could tie that into my theory. Yeah, the goal of all life is death.
My depression said yes.
And we all said, yeah, this is great. But it's like this innate and unconscious tendency towards self-destruction, right? I don't really know where I'm going with this, but I swear that I was going to relate it, like the death drive and like all of this to daddy destruction.
Daddy destruction.
Daddy destruction.
Papa, the destruction.
That was painful to listen to.
It's really hard rolling my tongue for Spanish, but.
Oh, God. Was that the attempt?
I feel like this is a face that shouldn't be photographed, this one, because it has something very suggestive about it. I suppose we'll have to post pictures of it at the time this podcast episode is released if you understand what we're saying.
Well, I think because it vaguely looks like a vagina.
No, I was going to say it looks like the way it's rolled. I mean, yeah, I guess the opening is vaginal, but this face looks like there's something very cylindrical in our mouths.
Oh, I totally forgot about the existence of penis. Even though we were just talking about fathers, I was like, what are you saying?
She said men? Don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. We were talking about princesses.
Obviously, a man isn't defined by their penis. Genitalia doesn't do anything in labeling. So
genitalia defines men. I don't think they can be identified by their genitalia, but I think penises very much define the way men behave. And I do mean heterosexual men.
Do you mean you're not meaning it literally, you're meaning what the penis is signifying, which is power.
Yes. No, I don't think men literally look at their genitals and they're like, you're going to define me, you 3-inch little buddy.
Remember in Wuthering Heights when Catherine's brother wanted like a toy or something and Catherine said, I want a gun. I want something phallic for power.
Yeah, no, I can't. Well,
that's what she wanted, a whip.
I love theorists who try and talk about phallic fallacy in literature, and they're like, oh, phallic objects this and sex that, and I'm like, you are a straight man. Like, this theory has come right out of the heart of a straight man. And they really said she held a cup, that's kind of, she wanted sex, and I said, no, she actually wanted water, literally wanted
water. I mean, unless you're like a Renaissance Italian author in which you literally mean she's asking for sex with her cup.
Well, I mean, if you paint a fully nude woman by a river, like holding a cup, and then you're going to say the cup represents sex, I'm not going to look at this naked woman by the river like, and be like, yeah, no, she's actually really modest. And
speaking of paintings of naked women, if you haven't watched Hannah Gadsby's Douglas, you're missing out, because she has a really great bit on how women in art are portrayed, and it still makes me laugh.
I've never seen it, so that was a good shot
for me too. It's genuinely funny. You should watch it. Hannah Gadsby is underrated. She's very good.
You're going to have to text it to me so I can watch it. I really hope that burp didn't pick up in the recording.
Hope it did, Lauda, if you can amplify that specific.
Yeah, she just makes a DJ sound level.
I would love DJ noises in the podcast.
I would kill for DJ noises. How are people going to know we're from Jersey?
Also, how are people going to know we're making good points? Like, just like in Disney Channel, when people say something like truly heartbreaking and you hear the audience go,
if Laura can do this, it would be amazing. Lau, if you can put the Hannah Montana like ooze in the background of this, I would crack up. Like the ooh, yeah. I would actually tear up. Oh, yeah. Okay, there was clearly no ending to this podcast. So Disney princesses, they are what they are. Watch it at your own risk.
Yeah, and if you have an argument for the subversion of a princess, or maybe you think any of the ones we talked about were actually really damaging, argue. I'd like to hear it.
Yeah, argue with Ambar. That's going to be the new
Trisha podcast. Doesn't like it when people disagree with her.
I don't like it at all. If you want to agree with me, you can DM Woman of the Lord. But if you want to disagree, you can just argue with Ambar.
But if you're a troll, I do stress. Bring your sources.
Yeah, that's facts. I would love... See, this is where I wish Instagram would let two people like run an account at the same time. Because I would love trolls. Like, obviously, we're not going to get trolls because we're not big. But, like, man, would I love arguing with trolls.
White men.
Me.
Talk to us. But that's it on this week's episode of Women of the Lord.
See you next week.
Ba-dum-boom-boom.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Big shout out to Kieran Choi and his brother Connor Choi. Check them out. You can find them on YouTube. You can also find them on Facebook and Instagram. And
also, big thank you to our sound designer, Laura Feliz. She is a recent graduate of TCNJ's graphic design program. Check out her Instagram for more information.
Women of Dolor aims to alienate no one and address everyone in discussing topics of culture, society, and humanity in a way that bridges gaps of understanding and illuminates misinformation.